Welcome to the El Arpa podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk. To a very special edition of the El Arpa podcast. Joining me right here in the building, right next to me, albeit at a socially responsible social distance of 2 meters, is Mary. So gone are the Skype podcasts, the posh part of Madrid's. You know, we can actually move around. We saw each other for the first time in like 3 months, 2 weeks ago, and now we're finally doing a podcast like the old times, back before the event. We're right next to each other. Well, with a 2 meter distance, of course. So Mary, welcome back to the podcast as it used to be. How are you feeling?
Thank you. I'm very excited.
Yeah.
This is much better.
Back in the studio, exactly. So it was a nightmare. Well, Skype is a great resource, but Skype, you know, trying to get the video off Skype and then editing it, and then the sound is not perfect, you know. So those days are gone. And we're going to talk about the new brilliant days where we're in phase two in Madrid and the rest of the country is in phase three. But we're passing to phase three probably next week, which means we can move around the country, which will be relevant, you know, in the next part of the podcast, or maybe even this one when we talk about it. So we can kind of move around and do some more projects maybe in different parts of the country. But, you know, we'll get to that. And in part two, we're going to talk about going to the Prado and going through the protocols and things like that. So this podcast is going to be cultural, but also an explanation on the de-escalation, unintentional rhyming there. But how you can start doing these things, like going to the museum and moving around the city with the new normal, to quote Pedro Sanchez. So we'll be kind of exploring those two things in this podcast, but Mary, what are your thoughts? We're phase two, almost at phase three. We're actually sitting in the same room now at the moment. So I don't know, hit me with your opinion stick.
It's just nice to be back to normal, or at least partially normal. So I don't know, we have these moments where things, like, obviously we haven't recovered our ordinary lives because there's a lot of things that are still not like they used to be, and we still have to be careful with elderly people and so on. But it's just really, really nice to, and well, I appreciated it before very much, so now it's like it's the same.
Oh, and this is actually great because we're at the apex of like appreciating each other. And within 2 weeks, you're going to be taking me for granted again. So this is the moment where...
Again, kisses.
I'm only joking, of course. But yeah, so it's interesting. I'm playing paddle again. Not that significant, but one of the English lads was telling me he flew back from England like a week or 2 weeks ago, which I was surprised about because if you listen to our last episode of the podcast, we said we were interviewed on Spain Speaks, and one of his updates, serious updates, was that Spain says yes to Germans but no to British travellers. So I was under the impression that flying from the UK was actually prohibited at the moment. Do you know anything about that?
Well, flying from anywhere was banned unless there was like you know, very important reason, or you've been seeing posts about flights to Ireland and so on out of need, so it was the same. But I think this was more referring to like the tourist season, because obviously like British and Germans are probably the two nationalities that we get the most of during the summer here. And certainly, well, in Spain from the 15th of June is like summer season already, so we're virtually entering that, and normally there would be like hordes of them coming over at the moment, but now it's going to be slightly slower. Well, The flights from Germany started today to the Balearic Islands. So we'll see how that goes. They were saying that they're taking people's temperatures, but they're not really testing them, so we'll see.
Yeah, so he was also saying that he had to wear the mask on the whole flight over, which is annoying. And then he had some problem with his passport, but he got through that. And then he was dancing because he was in Spain, and because it was so hot, he started sweating. And then he turned a corner, and there's like loads of police officers, and had to check his temperature. And like he said, he literally looked like he had the virus because he was sweating and like nervous. And and he got through it, but it gives an indication of kind of what it is to do these things right now.
You had an experience yourself.
What with temperature?
Had a hat resist, didn't you?
I did. Yeah. So I kind of went mad there. A couple of weeks ago, where I decided to cut my own hair again. The first time it worked really well. The second time, the machine didn't really work. I put the head on the razor, but for some reason it acted.
I'm sure it was the machine.
And it acted as a zero. And then I went to the hairdressers, and then they took my temperature. And because it was hot, and I'm Irish, you know, I just slightly raised temperature. And they were like, oh, we'll check it again. And they did. And it was like still kind of hot, but not really hot. But they're like, we'll just do it anyway, and they did, and they cut my hair, and they tried to fix what I did to myself, and now it's growing out, so I'm happy with that. And when we talk about the Prada and Paris, it'll be more temperature checking.
Okay.
Yeah. Thermometers galore, no? We mentioned that we, I'm not sure if we mentioned the last episode, but you know, the book, for example, has been on a list of banned books. No, it's been on the list in Marcel Bond's. Goose Stepping Guys in Black, Burning It. But no, it's a kind of famous bookshop here, and it was one of the first books to actually stock, or bookshops to actually stock our book. And they compiled a list of kind of must read books about the coronavirus and fake news and around that, and on their virtual window, our book was on that, which is quite a nice honor as well, but also interesting that they had a virtual window, because you can't really go out, or you couldn't go out and kind of take a glance at different bookshops and you know, have a sconce, as they say in Ireland, but now you can, but back then you couldn't, so they had to improvise with that. But we mentioned something very interesting, that we can go outside the city from next week onwards, which would be very relevant for us because we're working on a project and we're not going to reveal too much about it right now, but involves the cinema, your wonderful mother, Marisa, who I'm a big fan of, I have to say, and her memories of your grandfather's cinema in Anguilla.
No. My great grandfather.
I thought you meant great, isn't he? Was like just a legend, but
yeah,
you actually mean.
I've always been really excited.
See, you're not appreciating me anymore. It's already started, but so it's kind of we're doing it together, obviously. But this was your brainchild, and obviously we're not going to reveal too many details about it. But you have been doing a lot of detective work, and you found things related to Bunuel, the Civil War, distributors in Gran Via, kind of like sneaking in and watching movies. So what do you care to share with us about this?
I think you've already shared everything we want to share at this stage.
Fair enough.
But yeah, it's just one of these individual stories that fit within a bigger narrative of something that is not talked about quite as much in Spain. So I think it'd be really nice to be able to do that.
Yeah, and it's just a nice kind of bringing together of a personal recollection, and kind of these four memories of a family, and then kind of link it to something bigger, which would be the cinematic history of Spain. And what's interesting is like the fortunes of that cinema seem to mirror the cinema, the Cine Dore, which is in our tour, where in the 20s and 30s is very artistic, and in the later decades it's kind of a move towards more mass entertainment. But we'll park it there anyway, and we'll come back to it once it's done and it's garlanded with Oscars and Goyas and all those kind of awards. But we're also working on another project which we can't reveal too much about either, but it's interesting. It involves a poet coming to Madrid, and maybe stories around that. So we have high hopes for that as well. And I'm back on the ghostwriting ebook wagon.
Another thing that we cannot do much about.
Well, I can, because it's my project, so I will kind of like flout the rules a little bit there. But wagon's an interesting term because it's about the Dalton gang. I never heard of them. Have you ever heard of these guys? Oh, of course you have. So tell me, yeah, what you know about them.
Lucky Luke.
Yeah. I've never seen that, but I've heard the character. They appear in that and Huckleberry Hounds.
I can say purely in Spanish, like we used to, Lucky Luke.
Well, it's mad because I think I told you that, like, you two, when they're touring the Joshua Tree in 1987, dressed up as the Dalton Gang, or the Dalton Brothers, is kind of like country and western spoof bands, and they were their own warm-up act. In different stadiums, and it was all like an in-joke because Bono had met Hank Williams and he was like, you can make more money doing country and western than you can with rock and roll, with a few more expletives thrown into his advice. And so they came out like dressed in a certain way and talking with a southern drawl and going yeehaw and all that. And no, like, if you're in the front row of some of those concerts, you did realize, but a lot of people didn't, and even to this day it's kind of been lost in the ether as a story, you know. So it's kind of like a bit mad, but as always, it's been a fascinating book, because it's not just about the gang exploits, but also about the role of women in kind of western literature and cinema and society, but also the kind of role of the cowboy, different cultural forms to which the Daltons have appeared, like Lucky Luke. So with many things, you can always extrapolate a bigger and far richer story from that as well. So, well, anyway, that's all just the main course, or the starter to the main course. But we can talk about some more short films from Lebanon in the second part. And then the main course of the main course, going to the Prado and going through the coronavirus protocol. So it's back, baby. The part one, part two, and part three. It's back. We're back like before. And now it's time for the interlude. So here we are in part two of the show. Okay, so let's get the documentaries, the short films from Lebanon out of the way, because we hated them, which is very strange. I'm not supposed to say that, no?
Yes, okay.
I'm supposed to measure my opinion
it's
now.
It's a bit strong. We won't put it in the title.
No, I mean, I value the people who made it as human beings, but it wasn't to my taste. That's better.
Okay, that's it.
I think we were unlucky to go onto that website where they have all these Arabic movies and documentaries, and we've discussed the ones we've seen before and liked. And it was like some kind of sci-fi week, mm-hmm. where it was all kind of like based on sci-fi themes. So we watched one about a guy who was a Neanderthal. No, he's just an early human in the Stone Age period, and he goes through this kind of mystical journey and learns how to use fire and create art, culture, basically. I think it's the birth of culture is the idea. Then there's one about this kind of tower block where all of Palestine fits into this tower block, and that had an interesting premise, but maybe wasn't as good. And then the story of a woman who, and this was it was technically very well done, this one in particular. But she gets news that her husband's coming back after he's disappeared and was missing, and it turns into some kind of weird psychological thing, and then ends very abruptly with like an important message. So those are the three films in summary. I mean, for you, what are the standout details from one of them, or one that you connected with maybe the most? Or I can start if you wish.
I think the one with the early human in the Stone Age, as you described it.
What is he?
It's undefined, but let's not get into the technicalities of prehistory.
No, but I mean, I want to put this on record. Like, I've discovered that Chilean mummies are actually older than Egyptian mummies, and you are an Egyptologist.
Yes, I'm not traumatized by that, you know, like.
No, but I'm just saying, like, if you're, how can I take you seriously when it comes to archaeology and prehistory when you're studying the wrong mummies, you know?
The wrong mummies, like this, right, the wrong mummies. Yeah, okay, fair enough. Back to the Neanderthal slash early human slash Stone Age person. Yeah, I think that's probably the one that, I don't know if I liked it best, because I really didn't like the other two, and this was the third one we watched, so it was like, actually, it is better. But technically, I thought it was a lot more serious, you know, less like amateurish. And it was interesting. I didn't immediately do that association of like discovering art like you did. But it had some interesting elements. I don't think it's something you can describe. I mean, it's such a like short movie. I think you should have a... You should look.
And just feel. It's like a mood piece.
You should watch it.
Yeah. I think, yeah, I mean, it had a problem though. I like to call it the clean feet problem, where his feet were just immaculate and not dirty, you know.
Okay, yes, I was making little comments all the time because his eyebrows were like plucked perfectly, and he's meant to like be living in prehistory in a cave, and he hasn't even discovered fire, which he does during the movie, but his eyebrows are like perfectly plucked and he's got clean feet, so I just couldn't help myself. Historical accuracy.
You couldn't help yourself because he was just this Neanderthal, what's the words, man sexual kind of like
perfect, I don't know where you're going.
Perfectly groomed like a Stone Age David Beckham.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Whenever I see, he looks more like Mo Salah. But whenever like you see something like that, or a historical movie or prehistorical movie, you know, if you're in the trade, you just can't help pointing out details that are not accurate. What can I do?
Okay, well, the detail of Chilean mummies being older.
No, that's a fact.
Yeah. But you never thought it was important.
That wasn't in the documentary. We're talking about the documentary. The old ways are back. He's just asking me about this and I'm not related to what we're talking about.
Fair enough. I think, I guess the short documentary or film, they're just trying to create a mood rather than a three-act structure. Even though, I mean, it is possible to have a three-act structure in a 10-minute piece. But I just think, yeah, it's just showing something that's not normally filmed and just exploring whatever it is you get out of it and just kind of being in the mood of that. And again, technically very well done, especially the kind of psychedelic scenes where he's undergoing some brain revolution and suddenly he's awakened to the culture, or not, depending on your point of view. Now, I think... yeah, and then the other two, I just think like sometimes with short films, they just kind of go for either just very exaggerated shock or melodrama, or something that's just, like, doesn't make any sense, because like sci-fi, whatever, but like the Palestinian thing is interesting because it is about land and living rights and where you can live, and then putting all the Palestinian people into this humongous... you know, tower block is kind of symbolic in a sense, but you know, language, like film is a visual medium, and I think, you know, you can watch most films without the sound and get the story, you know. But I think just either we were visually illiterate for this particular story or the visual language was confused. I don't know which one it was, but there's just a lot of like kind of references that seemed either kind of cheap or tacked on. And you know, for example, the film ends with a pregnant woman kind of patting her belly and looking out over, you know, the wall to Israel, for example. And, okay, you know that the Palestinian conflict is defined by that relationship, but you're not, I just don't know what the film was trying to say, basically, you know. I think, you know, in the Stone Age film, it's open to interpretation, and that's because it's very well made and you can maybe look at it through different lenses. But with this one, it just seems like I just don't know what's going on, really. And maybe that's my fault, or not my fault, but I'm just, you know, not in the milieu, or I'm not versed in the imagery maybe of that particular story. But for me, it just seemed like that there's just no coherency to that particular story.
Yeah, I would agree. I didn't understand it. I thought the concept was very promising, and the whole idea of creating this tower for Palestinian people, and yeah, obviously there's a social commentary to be made there, but the actual execution was confusing, because in the end it was like, is this meant to be like a more progressive way of life than the heart? Because she looks out of the window and she sees Israel, and then when he zooms out you can see that this is just a tower where all the Palestinians are, and they're kept safe, but at the same time they're isolated to the point that she has like the one olive tree in the middle of her living room that she waters. And it's all kind of like futuristic, but it's sort of like the social message gets lost, in my opinion.
Okay, and then the other one, again, it's an interesting premise. So, as we said, a woman's husband comes back, and like, I think, again, it's a fantastic premise, because I think there's probably a lot of disruption to that event where someone disappears. That's traumatic. And then you kind of learn, maybe not learn to live without them, but you kind of adjust, and you still miss them, and your heart is broken, and you want to see them. But then you get the news that they're coming back, and it's a miracle. But also, probably, there's just a feeling like, how does my life readapt to how it was before, or kind of absorb this person again? Will I feel the same? Will they be the same? Will things be different? Can we pick things up like they were, you know? Maybe that's not true for some people, but for this character, it was, and I think that's a plausible premise. But I just think it ascends into kind of like almost like jump scares and just kind of jingle jangly kind of like sound design, which is very good, very well executed, but just to kind of indicate great tension and you know, that kind of thing. And she ends up, you know, there's a picture on the wall of him hugging her, and you can't see her, you can see him, so it's just the back of her head. And then she ends up shooting him for some reason. And then the ending kind of shot is a reverse of that picture. And again, I just feel like this is an interesting premise, but they just didn't know how to maybe tell that story in a dramatic way. I mean, not dramatic, but in a kind of just bring that premise to its logical conclusion, or just to tease it out. And they went down maybe the easy route of just kind of like, this is this heightened, super real kind of horror. And then again, this kind of confused symbolism at the end, maybe, or maybe I just didn't get the symbolism at the end of the reversal of the image. But you know, that was my interpretation of that particular movie as well.
I think it had a very valuable message, like you said, right at the end, about people that had disappeared and so on, and the whole idea of, you know, it's something that it doesn't get talked about a lot, I guess, but the whole idea of how the person feels that has stayed here, and then the other person comes back and they're just nervous, like, will they be the same person? And especially because they've changed, then probably the other person expects things to be the same as before they were taken. So all that is very interesting, but then it kind of like, yeah, it's got like that horror vibe where she's like chopping food and stuff. And yeah, that's all good, but then I don't know, it's sort of like not very clear, the conclusion, like you said, like she ends up shooting him and you're not really quite sure why, or at least we didn't really figure it out. So
yeah, I mean, I think
it's a shame, because
yeah, I mean, there's potential there, but it's just very interesting, because obviously disappearances and that concept is a huge thing, because we watched a documentary about the photographer who is trying to reclaim disappeared people through all these different techniques. And we discussed that in, I think, the second coronavirus quarantine special podcast. So yeah, so it's a very compelling story that can be told with those historical details. But I think an opportunity missed in two of those stories, and then the Stone Age one was decent. So yeah, I mean, I watched Scarface and I liked it. We could have spoken about that. You know, that was a good movie. But
Scarface, oh, Blast from the Past.
I know, right? But it's not like it's. Oh, actually, that reminds me. I must talk to you about Orson Welles once we're done and dusted with this podcast. Yeah. So that's. Too interesting to share on the podcast, but anyway, we'll talk about going to the Prado and that process of entering this building. So Mary, again, you invited me, you booked the tickets, you found out about the story. What is happening in the Prado right now? Yes, you are amazing. I acknowledge that.
Basically, they announced that El Prado was going to open again, but since they still had to keep like social distancing and something that was manageable, they decided to put the kind of like most famous 200 paintings in the same area. So they put them all together, a bit like in the old-fashioned way in the museums where they just, or art galleries where they just put all the, you know, all the frames together, one above each other. And yeah, we didn't know what to expect because they named this the comeback, or no, meeting up again. And yeah, we were just, well, it was like probably a once in a lifetime opportunity to see all this works of art all together. And you were right at the end with a practical observation, which is that when you go to El Prado, you don't have time to see it all. Like, it's a lot of hours you should spend there. And in the end, you end up sort of skipping through things. And perhaps this is like the lazy part of, you know, of this initiative. But I think from the perspective of the fact that it gives you a good glimpse of the main artistic areas that the museum covers, or artists, famous artists that the museum covers, I think that's it was really interesting. It wasn't actually as small as we thought it was gonna be. There was more open than we thought. Yeah, and then overall the experience wasn't too bad. I don't know what you found it like. This was the first thing we were actually doing outside the house. Yeah, I don't know, how did you find it in terms of getting in and all the measures?
Well, yeah, it was pretty straightforward. It was a cold day, so my temperature wasn't through the roof. And yeah, I mean, you just had your mask on, they took your temperature, they scanned your stuff like normal. People, there's only a certain number of people allowed into the forum, so you had enough space, and people were kind of responsible enough. So to be honest with you, I don't think it was that disruptive, or that you would really notice it, that you're going to the museum in the new normal, you know. Like, you had to go into one entrance and exit another, so there's like practical things you have to do, but it's not something that's ever present, you know, where you realize that you're in a strange situation. So yeah, overall quite comfortable, you know.
I think from that point of view, it was better than I thought. And then, well, there was a nice element, I guess, to the whole, like, welcome back type thing. It kind of felt that the museum knows what a symbol of the city they are, and, like, how they're world-renowned. So, you know, they had to... they wanted to do something to welcome people back into the museum, including tourists, because there were some tourists when we were there. So yeah, all in all, I think it was quite a nice experience. And the ticket was half the price, because it was meant to be to celebrate the fact that we were coming back, although I think it's also to do with the fact that you don't see anywhere near as many paintings as normal as you would normally. So rather than 16 euros, 8 euros... And yeah, but they're still doing like the 2 free hours at the end of the day and so on. So So I think it was a nice way to go back to doing what we usually do, which is going to exhibitions and going to museums.
Well, we should say, you know, as well that like there were some alterations, like the Velázquez, Las Meninas, all the people in that picture were wearing masks, you know, that had been superimposed onto the canvas.
Is this Twitter-based?
What's that?
Is this Twitter-based?
No, it's not, no. That obviously wasn't the case, but Las Meninas were there. A lot of Velázquez, Goya, El Greco, or at least one of his, Paul Rubens, for example. And yeah, so a best-of collection of the most amazing paintings. And it could be interesting because I read, you know, that even though it's emblematic and of Spanish art and the treasure trove of paintings in the city, it's not as visited as other museums around the world. So this could be a way to kickstart it once we go back to the actual normal rather than the new normal, and people can maybe visit it more. But it's a nice detail that the culture is being reawakened after the quarantine. Predominantly we saw Goya and Rubens. They seem to be heavily represented there. Now we have a kind of a differing view on Francisco Goya, the Goya, FG as I like to call him. You're not that much of a fan, are you?
No, well, that's a really bad thing to say on a podcast. No, I don't think, well, it's the same as many artists. Obviously, there's a difference between you appreciating what they do and their significance in Spanish art history in general, and they being like one of your favorite artists. That's for sure.
I quote, and just going to get a piece of paper here, a useless waste of space, end quote.
That's a utter lie. No, not at all. I mean, you know, there are obviously, to be honest, the thing that I find most interesting about Goya is more like all the part of like the all the dark and paintings, everything about the disasters and all that kind of like pessimistic you know, collection of paintings to do with like politics, society and so on, superstition and religion, and yeah, I find that quite interesting. Obviously there are all the paintings like, you know, the third of May, I don't know what it's called in English, shootings of the 3rd of May.
Third of May, yeah.
Just 3rd of May.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's an important like part of history that in a very famous painting, and then he's got other scenes, you know, even of like leisure or like the bourgeoisie playing games and being like outdoors and things like that, and of course all to do with like the king and the court, and so yeah, of course it's like one of our like Spain's most renowned painters. Yeah, probably I don't know, there are other styles that I prefer better.
I heard a rumor that when people ask you about Goya, tourists or whatever, you tell them that he's Portuguese, not Spanish.
What are you talking about?
That you try to disown him nationally, you personally.
Well, of course not, because like there's an issue here with Zaragoza, and I mean, you know, you should know better that my links to that part of the country are too large to ignore.
Seamus Heaney, the great Irish poet, and you wrote a very popular blog article about him.
Did I know?
You did, irishslicemadrid.com. And he came to Madrid for a month and lived in La FPS, and he was writing a collection of poetry. And he walked around the Prado and stumbled across at least two Goya paintings. One was the 3rd of May, and he was kind of blown away by it. And I guess also because at the time things in Northern Ireland were starting to kick off, and maybe he saw a correlation between those two different episodes separated by space and time. And also in his poem about Madrid, he talks about Saturn And that painting was also in that collection where Greco was representing Saturn. And I know the monster, was Saturn the monster? Or?
Yeah, Saturn, but Goya, not Greco.
I said Goya. Did I say Greco?
Yes.
well, I meant Goya. And so Saturn is eating his kids because he's like worried about losing power to one of his sons when they grow older, which also can be related to Scarface. But and also that reference is in the poem as well. So there's,
it's all related.
it's all there. It's just a fascinating museum because you obviously have the culture of the paintings themselves, but also the people have gone in there and interacted with them. Now, I love The Third of May in particular. I think it is a fantastic painting. We were discussing this as well. I've heard some people saying that the bodies are not that natural, like the human forms are not maybe as naturalistic. I don't really agree so much, but you're kind of saying that that the forms are, it's a kind of stylistic choice. And that also brought us to another discussion in the Prado. I mean, obviously these paintings are very familiar to you because you've studied them in school, and also in Spain, if you're not aware, like you do learn, I think it's obligatory to learn history of art before you can kind of choose it as an elective subject for your leaving exams, the bachelor at though. So a lot of people have a grounding in art. So, I mean, I guess the impact of some of these images is maybe diminished slightly because you're so familiar with them, no?
Well, I think it could be seen in two ways. I think, I was saying that to you about Las Meninas because it's been over-explained and overdone for me. But many others, I think it's the opposite because, like, when you see, for example, some of Velázquez paintings, because you've studied them so much, then, you know, and they're so significant culturally for Spain, then when you're in front of them, you're like, wow, that's quite impressive.
Okay, very good. And now we've established, the whole Goya thing, but in terms of style and aesthetic, is there a Spanish artist or an artist that's featured in the Prado that you're quite fond of?
That's quite a complicated question, a Spanish one.
Wasn't there a Scottish guy who painted kind of naturalistic scenes? You pointed out, I love that painting.
Oh, David Roberts.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, okay. I believe he was Scottish. He basically did a lot of very famous paintings of Egyptian archaeological remains. So I've got this is probably one of the first like art books that I got was like a really thick one of these touching ones of like David Roberts' watercolors. So actually seeing that particular one that was in Spain was quite interesting too. I believe that was what you were talking about. But I think there was also a Turner there. I kind of like very much too.
Yeah, I love Turner, but I didn't see the Turner there. Yeah.
Maybe you didn't turn towards the right one.
I'm going to ignore that.
Yeah, okay, forget it. Pretty sure it was there.
Yeah?
Yeah.
If you're so sure about it, why are you talking so softly now? In the opposite voice that indicates confidence. But no, yeah. It's a Prado, so lots of pictures of the baby Jesus, and a great one of like a kid Jesus in the temple debating with all the doctors.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Do you like that one?
Yeah.
Teenage Jesus.
Yeah, it was great because he was like, no, your appendix is not important, actually, you know, and things like that. And they captured what they captured. It's a mad scene, but there's another.
Well, it's a very famous episode of the Bible.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but then there's another one of Jesus as well, where he's receiving the Magi, and it's a huge painting, the Three Wise Men, and
okay,
yeah, and he's very tiny compared to the rest of them as well. So I think you overheard some American lady commenting on that, didn't you?
Yeah, because he was the very small baby. Yeah, very small baby. He was a very tiny baby in comparison to all the other figures. But the baby Jesus that I like the most is the one with the beard.
Yeah, why?
Well, that's quite a cute picture. It's a famous artist as well. It's called Murillo in Spain, and it's quite nice because at that time it was quite kind of like down to earth human portrayal of Jesus as a kid, playing with a little bird and a dog as well, and you know, it's like a family scene, and it's all kind of like very sweet and very human, which is sort of like departs from all the portrayal, very serious portrayals of Jesus.
Yes, it's true, because I know Caravaggio painted Mary Magdalene, and when she heard the news of Jesus being killed, and that's not in the Prado, that particular painting, but that was shocking because she was painting such a human style, like an everyday kind of style, rather than something biblical. So I wonder if that particular painting that you mentioned had such a dramatic effect as well, because it is a quite familial scene, and definitely, you know, not something that kind of conforms to the standard, I think, yeah.
Yeah, I think it definitely doesn't conform, because it's also based on like a fake gospel, really, because those scenes of like baby Jesus playing with birds, and there's an episode in like a fake, one of the fake gospels that says that he's playing with mud and creates little birds and then they start flying. So the representation of scenes like that from like what they are called like the fake gospels that are not included in the New Testament was quite new as well. And you're gonna make a joke about something.
What now? No, I'm listening.
It's not a joke, it's a question. Go
it's
on.
It's not a question.
Fire away.
It's neither, actually.
Okay, no, that's all I was going to say. So that's a departure as well, you know, using an episode from that is not in the New Testament.
Fair enough. And all I was going to say is, like, we can finish this part about the Prado, I guess, with Rubens. Now, there's a lot of Rubens there. Do you know much about Rubens?
Not as much as you.
I don't know anything about Rubens. I tried to watch a documentary about it, and I got halfway through. And so I will leave you with this. It's like Rubens has amplified the sound of his paintings with the darks, the dark colors amplifying the sound of the screams and torturous paintings, and elevating the size of his lovers in the softer paintings. Not my thoughts.
You're trying to quote from the documentary.
It's from the documentary. I was just doing that, but you cut me off there. I think I was very obviously, that's what I was doing. I set it up that way, and now it's going to elegantly come out of it again. Okay, so that was the Prado, and yeah, I think that's everything we have to say about it. So we'll meet you in part 3 of the show. So here we are at part 3.
It was so interesting.
Of the show. Yeah, it was, yeah. Okay, we'll let you in on a little secret. Like before, we recorded part 3 before part 2. So thank you for rumbling us again. But since you've done that, do you want to talk about where people can find us?
You can find us on Twitter at elarpa1, Facebook elarpa media, the podcast on a platform of YouTube, which you're probably using already. And our blog, irishsliceofmadrid.com.
Exactly. And also, don't forget to check out our website for our book, fakenewsbulos.es. That's .es. It is in Spanish, and it's just dedicated to selling more copies of the book. So, you know, naked ambition and greed there. But thank you for tuning in to another exciting edition of the Elarpa podcast. And you know, when we were interviewed on Madrid Metropolitan, they asked us how frequent our podcast was, or maybe it was Spain Speaks. But we'll be back next week, I'm sure, with another exciting installment. But until then, thank you very much, and good luck.
And good night.
Good lucky Luke, yeah.
Bye.
The El Arpa Podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk.